Don't you know? We're talking about a revolution. Sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, November 14, 2013, and we have a very exciting show planned for today. G. Edward Griffin is expected to join us today. That's the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island and is considered by many to be one of the leading authors on the subject of the Federal Reserve, which is, of course, what the subject of that book is. He's, we're still waiting for him to call in, so he's not quite with us yet, but as soon as he's on, as soon as he calls in, we'll get him on the show here. And Bill, I don't know about you, I've been really excited about having Ed on. I almost didn't even know where to begin once he gets on here, so I can hardly wait for him to show up. But in the meantime, why don't we talk a little bit about what has been happening in the news, including the fact that Janet Yellen is now appearing before Congress in her confirmation hearings to be the next Fed chairman, the next Ben Bernanke. And you and I were talking about that behind the scenes here before the show. You shared your little joke with me again about, you can tell everybody what the joke is. But it struck me.
Well, I mentioned it last week because it reminded me of the old saying, pig is still a pig even with lipstick on. And so I was saying that there wasn't anything exciting about Yellen because basically she's Ben Bernanke with lipstick and eyeshadow, maybe.
Well, fortunately, Mr. Griffin has joined us. He's on the line, and just let me give you a little quick introduction to the man. Ed Griffin is both a film producer and an author and a political lecturer, too. His most acclaimed work is The Creature from Jekyll Island, but he also has done a number of books and films, including a six-part series that he did under the title Hidden Agenda, Real Conspiracies That Affect Our Lives Today. I also know he did both a book and I believe a film on World Without Cancer, the story of vitamin B17, which we in fact discussed with him when he was on the show with us about 3 years ago. But he's back again, and it's actually probably been too long since we had him on the first time, and it was such an enjoyable treat talking to him then that we're very glad to invite him back now and to welcome him back now. So Ed Griffin, thanks so much for joining us today here on the Freedom News Hour.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Bill and I were going back and forth with about all the possible questions we could ask you, and we got a long list. I don't think we'll get through them all during the show.
We'll start with the easy ones, please.
Well, we'll start with the easiest one that I know of, which is what Bill and I were just talking about, Janet Yellen being checked out by the Congress to see whether or not she's good enough to be the Fed chairman. Some of the comments that got published today in the last couple of days about
chairperson.
Excuse me. Yes, I'm sorry. The gender correct.
Oh, that's another topic, isn't it? All by itself. Well, to tell you the truth, that is a very easy one because I don't know much about her personally, so that part is easy to say I don't know. But what I do know is probably more important, and that is that it makes no difference who is being nominated. We know by the fact that they are being nominated that they are friends of the banking cartel, because those are the only kinds of people who get nominated to that position. She has to have, in some way, demonstrated in her professional career that she is totally sympathetic to the concept of fiat money and central banking, and she's willing, she's undoubtedly been approached, and she's willing to serve the cartel. So that much we know, and that's really all that we need to know.
Yeah, that's really true, isn't it? Although I have to admit, we spend a lot of time on this show dissecting and investigating all the aspects of the monetary policy situation. And so whenever anything comes up that a Fed chairman has to say, we have a lot of fun tearing them apart.
Yes. Well, I'm sure if you have her background researched, it would be very enlightening, but I'd be very surprised if she turns out to be a gold bug.
No, I don't think so.
or Leslie Fair adherent.
She was a vice chairperson of the Fed, and was the chair of one of the regional Fed banks for years. So she's been very much a handmaiden, if I can use that word, to Ben Bernanke, and it basically agrees with everything Bernanke has done and intended.
Yeah. Sure. Well, that just figures she's a tested entity. She's a proven entity. So, yeah, she's a logical choice.
I love one of the comments that came out of her hearing the other day. She was asked by she was actually challenged by a number of people from both the left and the right, interestingly enough. And in response to a question about whether or not they're going to actually see any benefits from the QEs that have been going on, her response was, the ripple effects go through the economy and bring benefits to, I would say, all Americans. If we can generate more robust recovery in the context of price stability, then more Americans will see meaningful increases in their well-being. And I found that would be kind of humorous, because Ben Bernanke's been telling us all this time for like the last 5-6 years or so that we've had extremely low inflation. We actually have been facing a risk of deflation. So now here's Yellen coming along and saying, well, now we need to have a context of price stability. Okay, yeah. Well, what does that look like?
Yeah, right. It's just words, isn't it? It sounds like she was probably reading one of Bernanke's old speeches, but she just swapped a couple of words. I guess you know that there was a guy who was working for the Fed. I've forgotten his name at the moment, but they're calling him whistleblowers in the alternate media. Whistleblower, I should say. Because he was involved in actually administering these bailout programs and the QE program, and he finally said, I've had enough, and he made some very strong statements, says that this has not served the American people, but it's the greatest hidden bailout of Wall Street ever. And, that's really what it is. I think most people who have been paying attention know that now. So it's not really controversial anymore, except for Joe Sixpack, who's been thinking that these guys are there to help him. He might do it, huh? But most people know that that's really what's been going on.
Yeah, the whistleblower is Andrew Huszar.
Yeah, that's there. Who's
passed us along to Walt, but yeah. It was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal.
Right.
Confessions of a quantitative easer, and he was responsible for like several years, 4 or 5 years, of doing the quantitative easing program.
Yes.
And he says it had no effect whatsoever. And here was the bottom line. The Fed may have created and spent over $4 trillion for a total return of as little as 0.25% of GDP, or a mere $40 billion bump in the U.S. economic output.
Yeah.
So if you add $4 trillion to the economy, you get a $40 billion bump, primarily in the stock market for a variety of different reasons.
Yeah.
So you're just pointing out, you guys just got fed up. This wasn't accomplishing anything.
Well, except transfer of wealth. That money, most of it wound up in the balance sheets of the banks. And that's what he's basically saying, is that those are the guys that benefited. And it comes as no surprise, because we know that the Fed is not a government agency. It's not there to serve the people. It's a banking cartel. So, duh, what does a cartel do? It serves the interests of the members of the cartel. So that's what it was designed to do from the very beginning, and that's what Huszar has been saying, basically. And this should be no surprise.
I've tried to explain in our previous shows exactly what goes on and how Wall Street benefits from all of this quantitative easing.
Yeah.
But maybe I got the story wrong. What they seem to be doing is, because the big companies are the only ones that can borrow money at these very low interest rates, they're buying back their own stock so that all of the different companies have a rising stock price. So that's creating a stock bubble. That is only a consequence of the quantitative easing.
Undoubtedly, yeah, because you know by the earnings ratios of these corporations that there's no justification for the rising price of stock. It's certainly not anticipated in future dividends. So where does it come from? It's just the fact that this money is flooding through Wall Street, and they had to do something with it, so they bid up the prices of the stocks.
So their customers and investors get a capital gain, which has lower tax on it than income.
Right.
And they avoid, as well, the corporate taxes they would otherwise get if they were investing it in productive uses.
Yeah, that's right. Golly, it's a mess, isn't it? So when do we get when do we get mad enough? And I say we, I'm talking about the American people. When do we get mad enough to change all this?
Well, I think the anger is starting to come, but it's also kind of a funny mess, because one of the reasons why they get so excited about the stock market rising, they figure that's like the precursor of the next boom, is because that's what they identified was happening, you know, first time that they really identified it was during the Roaring Twenties, which led to the stock market crash.
Yeah,
but they figure that every time that you see the stock market moving ahead of the economy, they figure, well, that's a sign the economy is booming. So all we have to do is make the stock market boom, and that'll be a sign.
Yeah, we've been conditioned to accept that. And, of course, another factor since the 20s, Americans have pretty much abandoned any serious savings program in terms of, you know, putting money into something which is a secure asset. And they now consider the stock market to be their savings program. So when they see the market go up, they, oh, good, my savings have just increased in value. So they're happy. Even the people who are the small players tend to get a rosy feeling for that, because they think that, you know, the value of their retirement plan and their little savings program has all gone up. They don't realize that maybe the numbers have gone up, the dollar numbers have gone up, but the purchasing power of those dollars is going down at the same rate, if not greater. So they wind up in a net loss position.
Yeah, and making sure you don't realize how much of a net loss it is. In fact, I was just kind of offhand doing a little research into where we have been over the last 50 years in terms of purchasing power. And so I decided to go back to 1980. That was right after the stagflation period, so I figured that was like a good benchmark period. Starting there, what was the median annual family income in the United States, and then compare it to today? And it turned out the median was around 45, 46,000 at that point. Today it's around 50,000. It peaked around 56,000 in the mid-2000s, like around 2006, 2007, something like that. So basically, when you iron it all out, it's about 8.5%, 9% increase over the last 40 years. And meanwhile, the purchasing power has dropped by about 63%. So what used to cost a dollar now costs $2.66.
Yeah,
so that's a great trade, don't you think?
Yeah, and everybody's so happy about it because the price of their house went up. someday I'd like to see somebody get serious about a new cost of living index and based on McDonald's hamburgers or something like that. I've tried to do that myself as sort of as a little dabbling hobby. I really haven't had time to zero out all the adjustments that are necessary, but I get a pretty good idea that if we could find out what the real cost of a McDonald's hamburger would have been back in 1913, of course they didn't exist then, but
yeah, that would have been tough.
Yeah, that gets a little complicated, but there were hamburgers and of the comparable size. And anyway, if we could do that and if we came up with a hamburger index, I am sure that I would come up with the fact that my house today is worth approximately the same number of hamburgers as it was, would have been back in 1913 if it had existed then.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe I'm confusing books here, but I thought in your book, A Creature from Jekyll Island, you did the same kind of thing with like a steak dinner in Britain or something like that.
No, I didn't use that. That would have been a good one, a steak dinner. I did go back further in antiquity and compare the cost of a suit of clothes or a toga and a handcrafted belt and a pair of sandals. You know, you compare that to a nice suit today and a handcrafted belt and fine pair of shoes. It's about the same in terms of gold. So, but anyway, people lose sight of that. It's pretty simple. I think even most grade school kids can understand that.
Yeah.
But people don't talk that way anymore.
The other thing that really gets my attention, and I just noticed this in the last couple of years, economics textbooks, particularly first year 101 textbooks, when they talk about the characteristics of money, there's one characteristic they don't talk about anymore. It's something that somewhere between, say, 50 years ago and today, they seem to have dropped it from the curricula. And that is the idea of the money supply retaining value, being a holder of value.
Mm.
I was amazed. I mean, they eliminated that from the whole concept.
Well, that's pretty nifty because it doesn't retain value anymore.
Yeah, really?
It would be embarrassing to have that concept hanging around, wouldn't it?
but it just struck me, like, wow, I mean, that was a major tenet of monetary theory 56 years ago, and it's gone.
Yeah, completely gone. Now it's just the exchange value, purchasing power, not even purchasing power, just numbers, that's about it.
Well, the big argument is confidence. As long as the public has confidence in it, then it still retains value, which is kind of silly because you don't really have any choice about what currency you use, but nevertheless.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's true. That kind of makes it a confidence game, doesn't it?
It does. It's a con game, yeah.
Yeah.
I enjoy using that particular analogy because I think it's a really, really good one. So, Bill, you had a whole bunch of questions. Grab one of your questions.
Well, let me explain why I suggest having Ed on is because I'm a member of his organization, which is Freedom Force, and get his newsletter occasionally. And there was a recent entry in the newsletter saying that instead of making a flat, outright prohibition against fiat money, it occurred to me that it might be more acceptable to more people if, instead of flatly prohibiting fiat money, we would advocate freedom of choice to accept or reject any currency, including that issued by the state. And the statement kind of puzzled me because, I mean, if there's anybody who is anti-fiat money, it's you, and saying that idea doesn't sell, and therefore maybe we should go to this competitive thing. Can you explain your thinking?
Well, yes, I'm glad you brought that up, Bill, because it's not that I was advocating that. It's not that I would prefer that. You know, and that's one of the reasons I have never run for political office in all these years that I've been crusading, is because I know that I would just blurt it out just the way I see it, and let the chips fall where they may, which would have ensured my unelectability. what I was trying to get at there, Bill, is that it has been argued that the average guy out there is not ready to endorse any candidate who advocates a complete abolition of fiat money, because first of all, they don't even know what fiat money is.
Mm.
And so any guy trying to get traction politically on the hard line is really got a steep hill to climb. And then I got to thinking about the fact that Ron Paul came up with this freedom of choice in currency proposal. And although at the time I thought it was kind of a sellout and a compromise, I got to rethinking it, and I thought, you know, maybe there's some wisdom to that. Because most people, if they don't understand an issue, will certainly agree that people should have choice. If you like it, you can have it. If you don't like it, you don't have to accept it. That's kind of a grade school level of justice, you know? Well, I don't have to do it if I don't want to, so I don't care if you do it or not. It has a certain element of fairness to it, and I thought, well, you know, if that would be possible to get rid of the legal tender laws which force people to accept the fiat money, and gave them the option to accept any currency or anything as a money, even Disneyland tickets or something, or books, or what they used to have, the old blue stamps and things like, whatever people wanted
green
to
stamps,
use.
Green stamps.
That's the nice green stamp.
Yeah, actually those did exchange as money for a while.
They did.
Yeah. And everybody knows that, you know, during times of crisis, things become money, like cigarettes and, gosh, food, things like that. So anyway, if people had the ability to accept or reject any currency, that it wouldn't take long before the superior quality of real money, backed by something of tangible value, would become apparent, and that would rise to ascendancy. People would prefer it. The old fiat money would still circulate, but it would begin to be discounted until finally it would just be collectible items in somebody's drawer. So I thought that was a pretty good idea, and that's what I was trying to get at. Not that I preferred that, but I thought it might be kind of a more realistic way of achieving the goal, that's all.
Okay. Yeah, I like that idea a lot. I think it's a really strong idea.
First of all, what do you think of private fiat currency, such as Bitcoin?
I'm all for private fiat currency if you don't have to accept it. That's my point. If you've got freedom of choice, I think anybody ought to be able to offer anything they wish and let the consumer or the buyer decide. You know? I don't think we ought to outlaw fiat money.
But isn't any fiat money a fraud?
No, it's only a fraud if you conceal the fact that it's fiat money and if you force people to accept it. I mean, if I stand there in the street corner and print my picture on little pieces of paper and put my signature on it and offer it to anybody that wants to use it as money, I shouldn't be outlawed from doing so, but people would be crazy to accept it.
Only Griffins for a McDonald's burger.
Yeah. This Griffin bill is backed by two Macs or whatever, you know. Sometimes crazy ideas work. And I just, I don't believe in this central authority and this assumed wisdom of politicians and the wisdom of the group or the majority as making decisions like that. I think that the free market is the proper mechanism for making those decisions.
Hey, a one Griffin bill that was backed by two Big Macs would actually be superior to a dollar because the dollar isn't backed by anything.
That's right. But then you got to question Griffin. Does he really have those Macs? And if they are they rotten by now? Are they edible?
Well, let me ask you this second question on the competitive currencies. Don't we already have competitive currencies? I mean, you can use Canadian dollars all along the U.S. border. You could exchange any of your dollars you wanted to for yens or rands or anything else.
Well, we have a half freedom to do that, but we are forced to accept U.S. dollars in commerce. We have to. We cannot deny to accept them because there's a law requires that. So we have the freedom to accept other currencies as long as the government tells us that they're okay. I mean, we take a look at von Nothaus's liberties. You know, silver, they were perfectly good private currency backed by silver, but they were declared illegal and confiscated by the government. So, see, that's the element. When you get the government involved in these things and they start using coercion, and they always do it in the name of protecting you and protecting the public, that's always their excuse. But in fact, it's a complete restraint on free trade.
Yeah, it is. And I like the Ron Paul plan from the beginning, but I also recognize that there was a big flaw in the whole approach, which we haven't really talked about yet. And that flaw is it only addresses government regulation at the federal level. As it turns out, all 50 states and most of the territories and so forth also have currency laws. They have all kinds of requirements about what it takes if you want to be able to engage in using a currency in each of those areas of the United States. So it doesn't go far enough. It doesn't address everything that would need to be addressed, but it can. It can only be addressed at the federal level with a federal bill. But
yeah,
nevertheless, I think it's still a good idea.
Yeah, it looked like a good bellwether there to get the ball rolling and get people thinking in the right direction. So, as I said before, I came to a complete reversal on my position because I thought it might actually get some footage, get us closer to our goal without compromising our principle.
I think it's really
Are you familiar with the various, I think there's two or three states now that have passed not legal tender laws, but hard currency laws?
Yes, yes.
For example,
I love those ideas, too. Those are all steps in the right direction. Of course, the Constitution prohibits the states from issuing their own currency.
Right.
Unfortunately, I think that probably was a mistake, although it looked like a good idea in the beginning, because the founding fathers assumed that the federal government would always, be issuing real money. I don't think they ever dreamed in their wildest imaginations that they would start issuing the very bills of credit that the Constitution forbids and then turn that power over to a private bank. I mean, nobody in their right mind in those days would have thought that would have happened. So anyway, that it did happen, and that's what our problem is today.
I think historically it was a problem with the Confederacy, in particular Texas, issuing their own bills of credit without any backing at all. So they said, we're not going to let the states do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think also the founders didn't really pay much attention to who some of the citizens of the day were, because almost immediately after the Constitution was passed and made the law of the land, the first Bank of the United States was created, and they started issuing a fiat currency.
Yeah, right away. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't believe, I have to go back and check this, but I don't believe that there were legal tender laws enforcing it at that time. It was just custom and status.
Right.
But, you know.
Yeah, no, that's
one of the problems of having competing currencies is that they all have to be reevaluated in U.S. dollars. Otherwise, the income tax, the IRS, can't function.
Well, isn't that a shame?
Well, the only way the politicians would allow any kind of competing currencies is if they were automatically convertible to U.S. dollars.
Well, they can be converted.
Yeah.
That's not really a big problem, especially today with computers. I remember even 15, 20 years ago, I had a chance to do some traveling into little remote areas. You get off the plane and there's these little kids out there selling little trinkets and souvenirs made by the local people there. And they got their little pocket calculators, and they don't care what currency you've got, yen, American dollars, they don't care. They'll convert it in an instant and tell you exactly what it costs. And I hear Americans say, well, to convert currencies is too much, it's too complicated. I think these kids never been to school, but they figured it out real fast.
Yeah, it's the thing that you can't have too many credit cards. If you have both a Visa and a MasterCard, then you got two different kinds of calculations you have to do, and that's impossible.
That's right, that's right.
Of course.
Yeah, real simple.
Yeah. What computers are for, right?
It didn't. The conversion to dollars hasn't worked well for Bitcoin, primarily because the feds won't allow the banks to convert Bitcoins to dollars anymore. They have to register as, financial transaction or monetary conversion services and report all of the transactions to the Fed or somebody.
Yeah, something like that. It was inevitable that they would, the monster would eventually rear its head because they just cannot tolerate any competition like that.
Yeah. That's the key. You can't
have competition.
No competition. And that's why I like this idea of freedom of choice in currencies. Because competition, and not in every case, but usually it'll resolve the issue. And as long as the rules are kept clean and fair, no cheating allowed, no lying allowed, no coercion allowed, competition is great. Almost always produces a better product at a lower price or a better service at a lower price, and it benefits everyone.
And it's necessary because we already know historically that the other option, which is having the U.S. government protect us in the retention of a currency that has integrity and so forth, we already know that they violate that tenet over and over and over again. So they can't.
Oh, at the get-go, yeah. The word protection is just a cover, it's a decoy. It's protection, but it's not to protect us. It's to protect the people who control the money system and who benefit from the artificial manipulation of it and who benefit from the political favoritism as opposed to they don't want the competition. That's where the protection comes, protection against competition, but not protection of the common man.
Well, listen, we're about halfway through and time for us to take a break. Let's take that break, and then afterward we're going to talk a little bit more about the specifics regarding fiat systems and whether they're likely to collapse and what's going to happen over the next 100 years of the Fed, if God forbid it actually happens to stick with us. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back.
PRN.FM, bringing you new shows and fresh ideas every day. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is Tracker of Truth, Michael C. Rupert, host of the Lifeboat Hour, a nightclub at the end of the world, every Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern, right after the Gary Knoll Show, here on the Progressive Radio Network, only at PRN.FM. Join us every Sunday as we mix music, songs from my band New White Trash, Earth-based spirituality, new scientific truths, analysis, and hard facts to take a look at the week just passed and to get ready for the one that's coming. We may not solve anything, but we always come out with better understandings, a fresh perspective, and the inner strength. strength to inch our way forward towards a brighter and better and more just future. The Lifeboat Hour, Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, I'm Allison Rose Levy, the host of Connect the Dots. We're with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. On Connect the Dots, I connect the dots between your personal health and your total health environment. With a whole group of experts, advocates, activists, and wise people, that connect the dots between what goes on in our total world and how it affects health. Be with us every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time for Connect the Dots. Progressive Radio Network, we're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, host of The Expat Files, living in Latin America. If you've been wondering what it's really like to live, love, play, work, do business, or even retire in Latin America, tune in to The Expat Files, Fridays at 11:30 Eastern and Sunday at 11 Eastern. And don't forget, we'd like you to rate the show in iTunes. So if you're interested in jumping off that first world treadmill or just curious about Latin America, The Expat Files is just a ticket. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is Mike Fader. I want to tell you about my show, The Turning Point, broadcast every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. It's not just politics or pop culture or art or personal essays or storytelling. It's all of those. And it's in a spontaneous blend of stream of consciousness expression. It's not bad. Sex, children, work, beauty, ecstasy, death, regeneration. That's The Turning Point every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us. Now, you don't have to come with us, but what would the neighbors say?
This is PRN, the comprehensive news source for the world's progressive community. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
It's back here at the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown with Walt and Bill, and special guest Ed Griffin, author of The Creature from Jekyll Island and a number of other films and books. And Ed's been regaling us with some of his very insightful views about the Fed and what the past has been. Let's look a little bit at the future, because one of the reasons we are having Ed on the program today is because the Fed is about to celebrate its 100th birthday. It'll be in December. I think it's, Bill, it's December 23rd, is that right?
Yep.
I think that's what the date is, yeah. And so it becomes a centenarian, and I guess, Ed, the first question we need to ask you is, what do you think the odds are now that the Fed is 100 years old that it's going to end up in a nursing home?
Well, I don't think the Fed is headed for a nursery home or an old folks home, if that's what you mean, because even though it's getting older, it's getting stronger. I'm trying to think. I'm trying to think of an analogy, but I can't think of a good one right now. It's one of those creatures that is constantly replenishing itself. It's a lifeless thing. People are involved, but the institution itself is not human. It's like a corporation. You know, a corporation theoretically could continue for hundreds, if not thousands, of years while generations pass through it. Well, that's definitely what it is, because the Fed is a cartel. And as long as there are banks in existence, and as long as the federal government, with the permission of the American people, continues to give this cartel the monopoly power to issue the nation's money supply and lets them get away with legalized plunder, It could go on for hundreds and hundreds of years, although I don't think it will. I think that the time is coming that the forces that it has unleashed are so powerful that it's going to destroy the host. In other words, I look at the Fed as more or less like a parasite, and that it's living off the life force, the productivity of the American people. It's like Spanish moss sucking the lifeblood out of a beautiful oak tree. It can go on for quite a while, but eventually the oak tree dies. and then the Spanish moss dies also. I think that's more or less what's going to happen. I have a slogan that came to me one day, and I repeated it over because people like it. It focuses on what I really believe, and that's this, that we have to abolish, Americans have to abolish the Federal Reserve. If we don't, the Federal Reserve will abolish America.
Yeah, I can see where that fits very well.
Yeah, it focuses right to it. So I don't think it's going to go on forever, but it could go on all the way to the dismal end of life as we know it.
Well, then let's try this game. Let's look out 100 years from now, okay, which is almost impossible to do, but give it your best shot anyway. 100 years from now, is the Fed still in existence? If it is, how much longer does it have? And if it isn't, when did it die?
Well, I don't think the Fed, per se, will be in existence much longer, because even if the cartel continues, I think it'll metamorph into something else. I think that the IMF and the international community of central banks are maneuvering right now to transist into an international currency, an international central bank, if you will. And the Fed will likely, in my view, become just part of that larger, bigger entity. However, that doesn't mean that the players will change. I think that the same players will probably dominate the new international agency that replaces the Fed. I think the Fed will continue as it does now. Really, the Fed is the international seat of power for this finance. It's just not recognized as such. But when they finally say, okay, now this is the job of the IMF, and they may call it some kind of a World Bank or something like that, nothing will really change except that it will be thought of as international in scope instead of with American dominance, you know. So I'm not saying this very well, I realize. What I'm trying, let me try one more shot at it. I think that the Fed will no longer be thought of as the Fed, as powerful as it is, but the players in the Fed will have moved up a notch, and they will now be astride the world new central bank, and the game will continue under a different name. That's kind of what I'm getting at.
So it'll be like a Fed to the IMF or something like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, assuming the fact that the three of us agree with is that the parasite is eventually going to kill the host, and it's more likely than not that this will be a sudden collapse than a very slow petering out. What is going to be the political consequences if there's a worldwide collapse in fiat systems? What is the average person going to think or feel about what ought to be done to fix it?
Well, this is where it gets to be a very frustrating and unpleasant picture. I wish you hadn't asked me that.
I would throw out a question.
Yeah.
You can take another question if you like.
Yeah, any more questions? Because this is why I would never run for office, because I'm going to tell you the truth, what I really think, and it's not a pleasant picture. It's not pretty at all. I think, first of all, let's back up just a notch. What will happen depends on the degree to which the American people, and to some extent the people of the world, quickly awaken to the reality of what's going on. It's still possible, I believe, to change all of this. We still have the power to do that, but time is running out, and right now I don't see that awakening happening quickly enough. But that doesn't mean it can't happen. It doesn't mean that it won't happen, because we're doing our best to accelerate that awareness, aren't we? So we're doing our best to change how the outcome will be. But right now, the locomotive is running in the opposite direction on the track. And if it is allowed to continue running in that direction, I think what is likely to happen is that the crisis will deepen. All of a sudden, all the little reserves will be used up. The food supplies will finally, the warehouses will be empty, and all of the reserves from our previous affluent existence will be pretty well exhausted, and we can see it starting in Europe right now. All of the people who have been taught from birth that the government will take care of them are very angry now because their benefits are being taken away from them, and so they're rioting, and there is increased civil unrest and talk of revolution and revolt and so forth. And all of the nations of the world, and all even the local police forces in the United States, we know because they talk about it, are preparing for extensive unrest, violence in the streets. And that leads only to one thing, and of course that's martial law.
Right.
And in a large measure, this is what the people at the top really want, because it will give them an excuse to clamp down on society as a whole in the name of being our saviors. They'll say, okay, there's violence in the street, there's blood in the streets, and now here we come with martial law, and we're going to be patrolling the streets, and we'll be able to get all the bad guys out of the way and put them into the camps, and we'll be able to reallocate resources, and we can make sure that you have a job, but of course we'll have to move you to a new location, and we'll need your house for other purposes. And people will say, oh, well, thank God you're protecting us from all this violence. So this is a very pessimistic view, but this is where we are headed. If we get there, I don't know, but if we don't change direction, that is where we're headed. And under those conditions, I'm afraid that the average guy out there is going to be grateful for martial law. He's going to be grateful to be relocated to a new spot. He'll be grateful to be given some kind of a job that's been allocated to him. He'll be grateful for whatever credits he gets on his chip embedded in his hand so he can go buy food. He'll be grateful, grateful, grateful for becoming a slave. And this is how the whole thing ends up in the worst case scenario. And that's why, by golly, we have to do everything we can to reverse the direction. We've got to stop that locomotive from going in this direction. We've got to slow it down, stop it, and reverse it and head it in the other direction.
Well, no, I'm
completely depressed. Let me ask you first of optimism instead of pessimism.
Yeah. Yeah, what will it take to do that?
Yeah, well, let me ask it this way. Is there any political trend, politically, with regard to monetary policy that you find encouraging? I sense a dominant, growing irritation on both the left and the right of the political spectrum against corporatism. Is that an encouraging development, that they're realizing the government is run to benefit large favored corporations?
Well, the reason I hesitated for a second is that there's, in my view, there's some good and some bad in that. It certainly is encouraging to see this rising awareness of that problem and anger and resolve to do something about it. But unfortunately, I think most of the people who are experiencing this awareness don't really yet understand that it is a partnership between government and corporations. They talk about it, but they don't really understand it, because if you notice the opposition groups that are out there, they want to close down Wall Street. Well, how do they want to close it down? They want more government regulations, don't they? They want more power to the government, and that is the very problem, you see. So they recognize the problem, but they don't recognize the cause of the problem. And so unless they have a little more education, they're going to be demanding more of the very thing that caused the problem in the first place. They're going to continue to trust their leadership, the same people that are in office now. If they just say the right words in their campaign speeches, people put too much credence in what these politicians say in speeches. They don't look at what they actually do when they get into office. They just would rather sit in front of their televisions and listen to the speeches. And they say, oh, boy, he said it right there, didn't he? Oh, I'm going to vote for him. He said it right. But they don't notice that they talk out of one side of their mouth, and then they vote differently. So,
well, it's interesting what's happening in that regard in terms of the willingness of people to recognize that Barack Obama was flat out intentionally lying about the provisions in Obamacare. And as a consequence, his favorability rating has been crashing But I think that may be an encouraging political development there, just recognizing.
Well, it is. I agree with that. But what bothers me, and I'm not trying to go back to pessimism again now, but I'm trying to be realistic, is that, okay, they said, well, yeah, Obama lied. So the next guy will come along, and he'll lie too. But we don't know that he's lying yet until after we've given him 4 or 8 years in office. Then we say, oh, he lied too. Well, Bush lied, and Clinton lied, and Nixon lied, and they all lied. But it didn't make, you know, nobody gets it. They don't get it.
They're lying, so the test is there.
Yeah. So they, so as long as we've got this grip of the two-party system, and they're both parties are pretty much the same, but they lie about it. They like to say that they're different, and they speak differently, but when they're elected, they do the same thing. Don't people notice that? No, they would rather listen to the speeches, you know?
I've been involved in the Republican Liberty Caucus, which is trying to bring libertarian economic and social principles into the Republican Party. And I constantly have to point out to people who aren't so familiar with it that the worst status in the world in terms of economic policy were people like Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and George Bush.
Yeah.
They did far worse things and destroyed the economy more than any Democratic president ever has, as well, since FDR.
George Bush? Well, both of them.
Yeah. Well, you know, people don't want to hear that because that means that they made a mistake. And
right.
So you're subtly and subconsciously, you're criticizing their judgment or their knowledge base, you know, saying, well, I don't agree with that. These guys were good. How do I know they're good? Because I voted for them. And I wouldn't vote for a bad person, would I?
You know. Yeah, but they held the right issue. They held the right stance on abortion and on gay marriage, so they must have been right.
Yeah, well, yeah. Those things, yeah, there are always a few things that get a lot of focus, and not that they shouldn't, but the really big issues, you know, what is our foreign policy based on? What about the stance on money? What about the stance on our sovereignty as a nation, you know? What is the proper function of the state? Should it be protecting us, or should it be providing for us and directing our lives? The really the big issues that you never hear about, those aren't even discussed. They're not allowed into the debate arena. You can debate about gay marriage all you want, but not about, you know, loss of American sovereignty.
Well, you've got me swishing the cyanide around in the glass here and thinking about putting it down my throat. But before I do that, is there any reason for optimism in your view? Anything at all that you can see?
I think there is. I really do. But in order to really bring that into focus, it was hard for me to back off from the short view of history. I remember when I was really a young guy, and which goes back a long time, I was very impatient with some of the older guys that had been fighting this battle for some years because they kept saying, well, it's going to take a little while to turn this around. And I was impatient. I said, heck with that noise. I want it now. What about the next election? You know, what can we do now to change things by the next election? Let's really get serious. Let these old guys just retire. We're the young guys. We're going to change things. Well, now I'm one of the old guys, and I realize the wisdom of that. It took us about 100 years or more to unwind this beautiful system we had. I mean, it wasn't perfect. It was kind of a beta model, really, for a constitutional republic. But as a beta model, it was astoundingly great. It was beautiful. And it took about 100 years for collectivists quietly working in the background to unwind that. And they did it not through military power or anything like that. They just penetrated into the power centers of society, into the political parties, into the media centers, you know, into the think tanks, into the universities, schools, and so forth. And they took them 100 years. So we're not going to unwind that in the next election. But by starting the process of laying this foundation of understanding and having a blueprint of what we should do that's better than that, we are right now laying the foundation for a generational change that, in my view, is destined to happen now. We've already laid the foundation so well that they cannot stop it. It's not going to happen in 2 years or 4 years, but it is going to happen. And that, to me, is a source of great satisfaction. I can go to bed at night now thinking, well, I laid another brick in that foundation. Yes, it may get to be pretty bad in my lifetime, it may be pretty bad in the next 5 or 10 years, but in the long run, we're changing the world. And I take great comfort in that.
On that topic, because we're running low on time, I want to give you an opportunity to toot your horn a little bit. Freedom Force International has been around for several years now, and maybe you can give us a quick summary of what its objectives are. Basically, you already have.
Yeah, that's what I was
talking
about.
But I'm wondering, my question is, in terms of Freedom Force goals, do you think you're making progress?
Well, yes. Let's start with the goals. I did talk indirectly about those just a moment ago when I mentioned laying the foundation. That's exactly what we're trying to do, and we're bringing together people of like mind literally from all around the world. We have members in 65 countries now. The problem is the same everywhere. This is not a national war, one country against another. This is a war of ideologies, the war of individualism versus collectivism. And our people recognize that. And so we're joining together and creating a network. As you know, Bill, you're a member. And this network is allowing people to cooperate with each other and to lay strategies and help each other penetrate into the power centers of society where everything happens. It's where the action really is, and to gradually gain influence in there and defuse this power that is already in the hands of collectivists at the top of all of these organizations, such as the political parties and the media centers and so forth. It is happening already, and all we need to do is just keep doing more of the same. And that's what Freedom Force is all about, and anybody that really wants to become a part of really changing the world and not just complaining about it, they ought to come onto our website and start to read our materials and check us out, see what our plan is, and I think they're going to like it. So the website is freedomforceinternational.org. And anybody that's interested, I think they should plan to spend a couple of hours at least in looking through our material.
And Freedom Force International, the word international is spelled out, correct?
Yes, it's spelled out, and it's .org for organization.
Right, okay, good. So we can send our loyal listeners there, and they don't have to use the cyanide. That's a good thing.
No, save the cyanide.
Freedom Force International strikes me as being somewhat anti-political. But isn't political policy the problem, or is it the culture?
Well, it's not anti-political. It's anti-political first. In other words, if somebody goes into this arena thinking that all they got to do is align with a political party and that the solution is found in politics, I think they're making a big mistake. The people in Freedom Force recognize that the higher loyalty, the higher principle, are the concepts, the ideology, what we believe in. If we don't know what we believe in, if we came to power, let's say, 20 years or 50 years, and all of the people who believed as, you know, like we do, were upset with the present system, and all of a sudden we're populating the government, if we didn't have the right concept, well, we would become just as corrupt as the ones that are there now. So it's important to have a clear grasp of what your principles are before you start to use politics to implement those principles. And that's, I think, a very significant difference.
Would you characterize your creed as small L libertarian?
I would yes, a small L, or, yeah, a small L, I get your drift. You mean not libertarian party necessarily,
right,
but libertarian in principle, absolutely. You bet.
Okay. Good.
In fact, I'd love to see the Creed of Freedom, the Freedom Force Creed of Freedom, become the official creed of the Libertarian Party.
Well, wouldn't that be something?
Wouldn't that be something? I think it would.
Mm-hmm.
It would do one of two things. It would shake the tree a lot, and some of the people would drop out. But I think it would fertilize the roots, and the tree would grow faster.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Do you have any candidate for president you want to endorse?
No. No, I know.
Well, I'm asking indirectly because a lot of people are somewhat optimistic about the prospects for Rand Paul.
Well, it's not to me. It's not the question of the man. You know, if Rand Paul or Ron Paul or if Bill Westmiller or Ed Griffin became president, what the heck could we do? This is just one person alone. You know, I'm not saying that's not a good idea, but this has to be done clear across society. A good man in the White House could be completely blocked by the bureaucracy around him. You know, So, or worse.
Yeah, I think that's true. And in fact, what really makes the difference is whether or not the populace is behind the idea. If the populace is behind the idea, you almost don't even have to worry who got elected.
Exactly.
Bingo.
You've got it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because then it just becomes like a tsunami. And say what we want about, say, Obamacare. Obamacare got President Obama elected. And if it hadn't been for the swell support for it, I don't think he'd be in office. We don't have to like the idea, but the idea was clearly strong enough and held by a large enough proportion of the population that that's what made the whole thing get going.
Yeah.
There was a fellow that wrote a book some years ago called The Ominous Parallels Between Development of the Fascist Government in Germany and where things were progressing in the United States. And one thing that, turned to pessimism, but one thing I sense is that most voters still believe that they are electing a dictator who is going to solve all their problems and fix everything so we have a wonderful world. I think that's what got Obama elected.
Yeah, there's a blend of that. I think there's unfortunately, it's part of a human instinct. We do have a herd instinct, and we naturally gravitate toward leaders. We want leaders, and it's a very dangerous part of our nature. If we're not aware of it and not aware of how that can be used against us, we're always going to be ruled by demagogues who either as outright dictators who attain their power by the force of the sword, or who demagogues who attain their power by the force of words and rhetoric, claiming that they represent the people. You know, either way, they're still absolute dictators. And if we don't recognize the danger of both roads to that power, we're going to be in deep trouble.
One of these days, too, we have to recognize as a populace that presidents aren't Harry Potters. They don't have the Elder Wand, the most powerful wand in the world that'll solve all the problems. Unfortunately, that wand hasn't been invented yet.
Yes, and let's hope it never is, because it surely will fall into the hands of the wrong person.
Yeah, Harry Potter was a rare person. I don't think there's going to be too many of those in the banking circles.
Yeah, I haven't seen one yet.
Well, listen, Ed, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the program. I wish we had another hour to go, because I just want to keep talking. This is so much fun.
It is fun, and even though we're talking about terribly serious things, about as serious as a heart attack, still, if you can't laugh about some of these things, you're going to be very miserable. We have a little motto around here. Let's keep smiling and keep working, and it'll all come out fine.
And that's a good model. We'll keep that one, too. Thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
And, Bill, we'll see you next time.
Yep.
Actually, next week you're on your own. So you'll be handling that, but I'll be back next time after Thanksgiving, and we'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.